If you love true crime and dark stories, then you'll love our other podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia, with new episodes every Monday and Tuesday.
He told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking.
Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts.
You know, then this guy gets rich and he has some issues with sexual addiction.
Yeah, and control. Yeah. The Keith Raniere story.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts and don't miss a single episode.
In some ways, it starts to make things like Jeffrey Dahmer and that look tame, not in terms of the brutality of what they performed, but in terms of the psychology and manipulation of people.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Available wherever you download podcasts. Today on The Grave Talks, the Villisca Axe Murder House. A conversation with Greg Bacon. A family returns from church, a meal is served, children play, and eventually everyone retires to their beds for another night of sleep. However, this night would be like no other. It would be the final night of these eight souls' lives. From the shadows of the attic, it is believed that one man emerged and would swing his axe multiple times, brutally murdering the entire family. Who was this man? Why did he commit such a disturbed act? These are the questions that still linger today, as do the spirits of the Villisca Axe Murder House. Today, we discuss all this and more with paranormal investigator Greg Bacon.
This goes back to 1912, where there was a family called the Moore family, and it was the last day of school. For the family, and they invited two of their school friends over, so it's about eight people total, and they all went to church that night for the last day of school. They went to church, which is about maybe, oh, I'd say about 3-4 blocks from where the house is, the house of Villisca. They go to church. They, you know, probably have a good time. And they walk back home, and the two school children who stayed over with them, they ended up staying the night. They went to school, they went to church with them, then they came back and they stayed the night. But what ended up happening, and what they had no idea at the time, was that there was at least one person still in the house that they had no idea was there. And this person, and it could possibly be more than one person, it's never been verified, it's never been solved. This person had come out during the night when they were sleeping and murdered them all with an axe. Now, you know, that leads to a lot of questions, obviously, because that's kind of the story that you get when you go there or you look on the website or the established history. But when you really think about it, there's eight people in the house, one person with an axe, you know, and it shows, evidence shows that not everybody was asleep when things were happening. And so there's some rumors that go around with what actually really happened there. But to get back to the story itself, this was something that Villisca, Iowa, did not have a police department. They had what they call a peace officer. And this peace officer was inundated immediately. He was not equipped to handle a mass murder scene, and so people from around the area went to the murder scene, and they, in quotes, help clean up the murder scene itself, which immediately ruined any chance to really figure out what's going on. Over time, there were multiple people who were what you call they were brought to trial. One was a reverend that was brought to trial a couple times and was acquitted both times. He was linked to the murders in the sense that he talked about the murders happening while he's waiting for a train to leave out of Villisca. The problem is that he did that prior to anyone knowing about the murders happening. He did it early that morning, and it wasn't found out till later in the morning that these murders had happened. There's a lot of questions around it, but from that point onward, you know, depending on who you talk to, what you watch on TV or anything else, it's been said that that house has had some, you know, nasty energy in it, that there's people who had lived there growing up there who had been terrified to be in there. They saw things happen there that they never, that they can't explain. And, you know, back in the mid to late 1990s, I think the house became available. A man who kind of was in charge of the Villisca Preservation Society, he bought it and restored it to how it was back in the day, removed all the electricity and stuff. And then I think it was probably early 2000s that they started charging for people to stay the night there and do investigations. You do pay to do investigations there, but, you know, it's one of those, I hate to say it because it's gross to say it this way, Tony, but it's like a thrill place for investigators to go and do that. But the downside to that, of course, is that there are spirits of the children who died there. You know, the family is still there. You know, you go there and you can clearly have communication with the family still there. They haven't crossed over there, but there's also so much more there, and a lot of disgusting entities are there also. And I do want to just point out too that this story for Villisca was so big that it actually knocked off the Titanic as being like front page news stories in much of America.
Which is pretty amazing, because I'm a Titanic dork, and I was into Titanic way before the movie, but I was a kid who would literally go and get the microfilms and look at the headlines from April 14th, 1912, and then just go through the newspapers of that era for as many days ahead as I could. And it was Titanic as the headline for like almost a straight year on most newspapers throughout the country. So for something to bounce it off would have been quite a story. And obviously this was quite a story.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It's a story of horror. I want to get some insight into what kind of, and we can talk about some of the rumors and phrase them as such, but what kind of reputation did this family have around town prior to this event occurring?
I think that overall, it seemed like that the reputation seemed to be fine, but you know what, as time goes on, and none of this is verified, but there is a sort of belief that, not even a belief, a theory. How about that? There's a theory that the matriarch Josiah Moore, that possibly there was a link to the murders happening because perhaps he was having an affair with somebody else that was connected to the murders. And the problem with that is that that's not verified, and that you know, you got to be very careful about that, because you don't want to tarnish a reputation of somebody who we don't know all the facts to. And there are so many like too many players mm-hmm. in this, that you know, your mind go all over the place. There is a man who had was prosecuted for the Villisca Axe murder house mm-hmm. Killings, and he was not found guilty, and he went on to, I believe he went on to Colorado, and he killed his own mother with an axe.
Wow.
So it's like, but you know, it's, but there's so many, all these other people have, you know, like, they have reason to believe that they could be a part of it. And, you know, one of them being Reverend George Kelly, who I mentioned, you know, earlier, who was talking about the, you know, the murders, you know, he left town between, I think, 5 a.m. and 5:30. And that was hours before the bodies were discovered. When he was in court, he had mentioned that he had been around the area earlier. And he was intrigued by the Morris house because he thought he saw something which he called the shadow figure looking around, like kind of peeping around. Now, Reverend George Kelly is also known to have been a peeping Tom himself.
Okay.
It's very odd. And he had been accused of being a peeping Tom, and he even asked young women and girls to pose nude for him on several occasions, which, you know, had, you know, obviously, you know, gotten a lot of attention from, you know, police wherever he goes. He's one of those that would kind of, you know, travel around. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't based in Vlisk or anything like that.
It's like a bad game of Clue with this house as far as like who did what. The Reverend George Kelly, the fact that he had knowledge of the murder and he had mentioned this to someone at a train station prior to anyone else having any knowledge of it. How did he explain that? Was there ever any explanation that was given that would make any sort of logical sense?
You know, it's... It's really odd because it seemed like that he had, you know, displayed a fascination with the case afterwards. And when he went around, he talked about it quite a bit. He was arrested. He was arrested for other things, but I don't really know, to be honest myself, exactly how he was able to get off from it. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. You know, he even confessed to the murders in court, but the jury didn't believe his confession.
How bizarre.
It is bizarre. And, you know, also, just to kind of give a little bit more context to what I had brought up earlier regarding, you know, you asked about the reputation of the family. Mm-hmm. It was actually Iowa Senator Frank Jones, who Josiah worked for, but it was rumored that Josiah had an affair with Jones's daughter-in-law.
Okay.
But once again, there is no evidence that supports that either.
Sure.
So, you know, it's one of those cases that there's a lot of pieces that, and that's just two of them.
Yeah.
That's just two of, you know, we talked also about, you know, the other one, I think it's Henry Lee Moore, who was the one that ended up killing, you know, with an axe afterwards. And it's no relation to the Moore family. You know, there's just a few of them. There's so many. It's almost like a JFK sort of thing where there's so many people that were involved and that you can't really pin it, except for the one who admits to it and then is still acquitted.
How did the gentleman who was he was brought up on charges but then acquitted? How did he get into the picture as far as the one that they believed that they were going to try for this murder?
Well, he was the one that was talking about the killings before anyone else discovered the bodies.
So this is the Reverend.
This is the Reverend.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. I was thinking that. So this is George Kelly. This is the one he was. And then is he the one who killed his mother or whatever in Colorado?
No, that was Henry Lee.
Okay.
Moore.
So Henry Lee.
You know what I mean? There's so many.
Henry Lee is who I'm talking about. How did Henry Lee get brought up on charges, but then get acquitted? Like what tied him to the whole circle of everything here?
He was it appears to be that he was a suspected serial killer. Mm-hmm. And he had, as I said, killed his mother and grandmother after Vlisca. But I'm not 100% sure what it was that got them to look at him. It might have been just other acts murder, because I mean, it's like they said, he was suspected serial killer, and it might have been that he was there at the time of the killings and they went for it. I mean, I'm not, to be very honest, I'm not 100% certain on that.
What is very bizarre about the whole thing, when you look at it, is how one person with one axe could take out eight people and none of them were able to escape or try and overpower them. The family, what sort of ages are we talking here in terms of the family who passed away?
We're talking about Josiah was 43, Sarah, his wife, was 39, and then their four children. Herman was 11, Mary was 10, Arthur was 7, Paul was 5.
So several of them were small children.
They were very small children. Okay. And depending on who depending on what you're reading about the killings, you know, there's some that say that like the little girls who were in that were staying over, that they actually that a couple of them had axe marks on their forearms, like they were trying to defend themselves from axe blades. But I don't know if that's true or not. There's a lot of those sort of like, you know, what happened here, what happened there sort of thing. It was also possible that the children were possibly abused after they were killed. So it was there, you know, there's just layers of disgusting situations with this place and with what had happened there. I mean, if saying that an axe murder isn't bad enough, it just seems to get worse.
There's, you know, remnants here of, you know, Amityville that come to mind, where it's like, how did somebody walk through a house with a shotgun and murder all these people face down in their beds? How did somebody get into this house and kill this family with an axe and nobody gets out? But I guess there's a little more logic with this one, with the fact that there's so many small children that could have just been frightened and didn't know what to do. You know, you could probably take out the mom and the dad pretty quick with the axe. And then you got kids who are just confused and they're fucked essentially at that point. It's just absolutely horrific.
Well, can I also add real fast too, you know, when they say that the killer was hiding in the attic, you know, the area that I live, an attic to me is going to be the very top of the house where, you know, nobody goes, you just put storage and stuff up there. But you know, at the farmhouse, the attic is actually on the same level as the parents' bedroom and the children's bedroom. So it's all on the same lounge. So when they're going about their business, getting ready for bed, everything else, if what we believe is true and that the murderer had been staying in the attic, hiding in the attic, all this is with, you know, they're within just feet of their murderer for hours and don't even realize it.
Yeah. There's not like, oh, let's pull the attic door down and make a bunch of noise and then get to the other rooms of the house. He could easily, or she, likely he at that point in time, crept right over and done this. Go ahead.
I was just going to quickly say, you know, the parents' bedroom, there isn't a hallway where there's bedrooms. The parents' bedroom is like a landing on the second floor. You have to go up the stairs and you're right away in the parents' bedroom. There is no doors for their bedroom. The only doors is for the attic and for the and the doorway for the children's room. So there is, like you said, there is no like hiding around or anything. It is right there. And above where Josiah and Sarah slept, there is a mark on the ceiling that everyone believes is like when the killer went to, you know, actually get Sarah, that the axe hit the ceiling and it came down.
So the town rushing in to clean this all up very quickly, was that just goodwill gone bad, that they essentially tampered with a murder scene, but they really did have the best of intent? Or has anyone ever looked at that going, you know, was the town trying to cover up for somebody or anything of that nature?
It's such an interesting question, because, you know, early on when you hear about it, that's your first thought. I mean, my first thought was, oh, they're just, people don't know how to deal with such a situation. And it's a peace officer instead of a police officer, probably had no control over anything. They couldn't get the National Guard in right away. But then when you start looking at the fact of like Frank Jones, who is the Iowa State Senator, and that was who, if those rumors are true, where Josiah Moore was rumored to have an affair with Jones, his daughter-in-law, and that was more of a revenge thing, then, you know, you start to wonder. And the same goes with, like, you know, was he working with Reverend George Kelly, and he was able to get Kelly acquitted of murder, even though he, you know, completely he admits to it, but he doesn't admit to anyone else working with him on it. I mean, that's the interesting thing about it. I feel personally that, you know, obviously there has to be, I think there's more than one person there. But what doesn't fit, though, is if it was a revenge killing, the children wouldn't have been abused. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that would have been part of, you know, a revenge sort of thing. I mean, it becomes that you have one side that sounds like, oh, well, it's just, you know, get rid of somebody who has really done something wrong to my family. On the other side, you have somebody who is extremely sick and twisted, mm-hmm. who is working alone, working with someone else. But it's much more sinister than it even appears as sinister on the surface.
The town obviously got a lot of attention in the national press for this horrible, horrible crime. Most towns, you know, that's nothing they really want to put on their welcome to, you know, the town sign, Vasilla. I mean, that's not just, you know, Amityville hates Amityville, you know, the Amityville horror. How did the town deal with all this press? And you'd have to imagine at the time, too, kind of the gawkers and stuff that would show up and, oh, there's the house where that happened.
It's hard to say, because I think, you know, I think you had your like exposure up front, and then as time went on, I think that everyone kind of probably went back to some normality. I think where it's changed, though, was, you know, now you have it as basically some kind of tourist attraction, really. And the town is small. The town is a very small, very, you know, compressed place. You know, you think about, when I think about when I first heard about this house, I kind of thought it's in the middle of this field and it's very ominous and stuff. No, in fact, there's neighbors all around. There is a farmhouse in the back that was, you know, built and then rebuilt to allow people who investigate to, you know, kind of leave the house, because this back house has electricity, where the actual the actual Villisca house doesn't have electricity. Mm-hmm. And it's a very it's very unassuming, apart from a big sign that is next door. So it's hard to say. I do want to also add, if I may, you know, like I said, there's a neighbor right to the side of it. And there's been kind of a theory. The neighbor, her name is Mary Peckham, and the house still exists. And Johnny lives over there, and he's the caretaker for the Villisca Axe Murder House. And him and his wife and daughter had lived there for a number of years now. But as he had said, that because he can hear when investigations are going on at the house during the night, he suggests that there is no way that Mary Peckham didn't know what was happening in the house the night of the murders, because she could hear, you know, you could hear everything. And if you have kids and people screaming and you hear a lot of things, it sounded like he believes that she was too scared, you know, and I don't blame her. She was an old woman, but she just kind of had to endure it. She had to endure that horrible night. But he's like, I can hear everything. And I think they sleep where Mary Peckham would have slept. It's like, you know, the bedroom of the house.
What happened to the house after this crime was committed and the family is deceased?
The house, from what I know, just was sold, and other people had lived there over time. And mm-hmm. then there was a point, I think, in the 1990s that it was bought and meant to be kind of almost like some sort of like kind of a tourist place of some sort. And it wasn't until after the fact that it started to become clear that this could be used as a way to make money for people who want to go in there and do paranormal investigations. And it's been that way for a number of years now, where you can, during the day, you can go in and you can get a tour of the place, pay to get a tour of the place, or you can rent it out for the night, for the entire night, and you are completely able to do investigations there. And then, you know, kind of the sad part about it, though, is that, you know, this place is made into a tourist trap in a sense, because they have like almost a little gift shop in the back of the house that has electricity, you know, where you go and rest and stuff, where they sell shirts, and it has the pictures of the children on it with a, you know, a man in silhouette with an axe. You know, it's just like, this is really not good. But yet at the same time, I've been there. So, I mean, I guess I can't really call it as like, you know, I'm disgusted by it, yet I paid to go in there and try to investigate. You know, it's that weird sort of line.
Yeah, I mean, I see nothing wrong with trying to learn and use these places almost as labs for investigating and being able to do that. But yeah, there are certain things that I do kind of say it's very distasteful when you're putting pictures of the dead children in a, you know, a silhouette of a man that's going to kill them. That's kind of fucked up.
Totally.
One of the... I mean, I get it if you're like, you know, going to sell a T-shirt with the name of the place on it or something of that nature to try and fund. But everything with respect and taste is my opinion. I have no problem with somebody trying to sell things of a historic nature that makes people go, oh, yes, I've been here, with taste. That sounds really kind of just shitty. Let me ask you about with this house. I want to get into your experiences there. And before we do that, though, one more question, and maybe you can answer this because it would probably precede any of your experiences. To your knowledge, what are some of the earliest reports of hauntings on this property? How far back does it go? Considering people had lived there all the way up, it sounds like, from what you're aware of, into the early 90s. What, you know, how far back does it go? Was there reports while it was inhabited by people in the other decades where it was a home?
What I know for sure is that there was a family that was there in the, I think, 60s and 70s, who, and maybe into the 80s, who had experienced a lot of, you know, paranormal sort of unexplained things. One of them being, I think, a knife turned on the father of the house and cut him. And unfortunately my expertise in that had come from watching an episode of Ghost Adventures. There could have been more. There was talking about more, but the when they interviewed the two sisters who had lived in the house, they refused to walk into the house. One in particular refused to go in there because it was such a horrible experience being in the house during their childhood and living there. The other one went in and then had to leave. They couldn't handle it because the energy and the memories were so overwhelming. And it wasn't because of the family themselves. It was what they were saying, what was happening in the house. And I personally believe that the house, especially now that it has become this attraction where all of us are going in and paying to go in and do stuff, it's become kind of, I call it the STD of the paranormal. Mm-hmm. Because people go in there and they're doing, you know, they're doing seances, they're doing spells, they're doing things that they're conjuring, and you know, no one's there to kind of safeguard it. So I think, in my opinion, the stuff that, you know, gets Villisca its reputation now is more of the stuff that has happened since it's been open to everybody, opposed to what happened, you know, during the 60s, 70s and 80s and whatnot.
So your thought is that a lot of the things that are going on are not even have anything to do with the original inhabitants of the home or the murder, but it's more so the doors that have been opened by quote unquote investigators or people who really don't know what the hell they're doing and are inviting things in.
I feel so. Yes, I do feel that that is the case, that it's more because even after our visit there, and it happened, I think, a week after we were there, there was somebody who was in the house doing a investigation with the group, and he stabs himself.
Oh, my God.
And Yeah. And it's like, whoa, you know, it's like, what does this house do to people? And is it the house itself, or do people, as you probably know, going on investigations and being with paranormal people, you get kind of this group mentality of like, oh, this place is really, really bad. And suddenly you're kind of acting in ways that you haven't really acted before, even though it's not necessarily paranormal. It's kind of a group think sort of thing.
Yeah, it's the mob mentality, but it is a total other thing, though, where one is to act out and actively harm oneself. That's typically not what goes along with mob mentality.
You hope not.
Not normally, no, but that is kind of a scary thing. That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Greg Bacon. In part two, was there something paranormal involved in the murders at the Villisca Axe Murder House? What was it like for Greg the first time he investigated the house? How did the investigation of the Villisca Axe Murder House hit Greg so hard? And what did his experiences teach him? Also, what disturbing events happened to Greg and his crew after they left the house? And what does Greg believe the future holds for the future of the Villisca Axe Murder House? All of that and more in part two of our conversation. To hear it, be a supporter of the show, a gravekeeper. Sign up on our website at thegravetalks.com. Click Become a Gravekeeper, or directly through patreon.com/thegravetalks. It's only $5 a month to get access to all of our content, all of our interviews, hundreds of them for you to binge away on. All of our part ones and part twos, all there for you, as well as advanced episodes of the show, and it's all commercial free. That's what keeps our program on the air, is your support. Again, check it out, patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.